It was my favourite time of the day, is this time of twilight. You know, kind of the heat and the energy of the day is passing away, and the cool of the evening draws in. And it was a very lovely experience for me to be sitting here with my friends and companions, helpers, co-sufferers, and the gentle sunset, light fading, and the soft glow of the exit signs. The tender scuffling of the rats in the rafters. And that's what it's all about. That's what life's about. I remember once when I was at Fujongong with my friend Siri Panyo, and we were, you know, Fujongong is, it's pretty wild, you know. Kind of, here we are, we're an hour away from the Sala, and we're kind of up in the mountain, and they've got a kind of cave there, civilization, and some water tanks. It was shaving day, and we were shaving each other's heads there, and here we were out, lathered up, shaving out in the open air, and it started raining, and so we're kind of in the rain and bush around, and you're kind of squatting on the rocks trying to get a shave and stuff. And Sri Panda is just like, yeah, that's it. This is what it's all about. You know, this is it. This is the lifestyle. So that's what I really love about the what we're doing, about the forest tradition, and there's something really evocative and irreplaceable about the simply being. And doing what we're doing. And I think it's a very, I think it supplies a need. For some reason it speaks to a need, and speaks to something which certainly, you know, communicates to me. I can see this continuity between what we're doing here, between what my experience in the forest tradition in Thailand, and between, you know, what you read about in the suttas and and the Vinaya. Of course, it's not exactly the same. Of course, things change, and so on. But still, there's that essence is very much there, and that essence of simplicity and being with nature and all of those things. So it's it's not a rational thing. It's not something you can explain. But somehow there's a something to do with like the smell of the gum trees, or the feeling of ants crawling over you while you meditate, or something about that kind of lived experience, which is you're sitting there and you feel the ants crawl over you. And this was an overwhelming experience in my first meditation retreat. Of course, in Thailand is full of ants. That's one of the things they don't put on the insurance, on the tourist brochures. You know, Thailand's got millions of ants all over the place. And sitting in Wat Rampong and sitting in the room there and just having little ants crawl over you constantly. And sort of that's a big part of your meditation. When do you brush them off? And they reach the kind of the tip of your ear, and are they going to go inside? And if they do, are they going to come back out again? And that's a big part of your meditation. And you learn things about ants that you'd never have known about, or perhaps even never wanted to know about. It's kind of interesting when we travel in India and we sit in the parks and so on in Savatthi or Benares or something, and we kind of notice that there don't seem to be so many ants. But it's always a problem if you're in Thailand, it's just ants everywhere. But maybe India doesn't have so many. Maybe that's why they could develop their meditation there. And so, of course, you come here and it's the same thing. You know, you feel the ants crawling on you. And one of the things I discovered in my first retreat was they actually have like one of the according to the system they develop there, Vipassana Jnanas, one of the Vipassana Jnanas they call, Adinavana Vipassana Jnana or something, I can't remember exactly. The sort of contemplation is the stage where you sort of perceive the danger and drawbacks and everything becomes really loathsome, and during that stage you're constantly feeling as if the ants are crawling all over you, even when they're not. So you both get the real ants and the imaginary ants, which is something to deal with. And of course we come to Australia, and luckily enough we have ants in our kutis here as well, so we get to continue that great part of the tradition. I had one crawl inside my ear the other day, actually. So crawled out again that time. That's good. So this is kind of a breaching of boundaries, isn't it? You know, you get these little creatures that kind of want to be on your skin, and of course we normally think, my skin is mine. This is my skin. It belongs to me. And the kind of feeling of an ant crawling over is kind of unpleasant, even though in itself is nothing unpleasant, you know, unless it bites, okay, then it's painful, but if it's not biting, it's just crawling, it's not actually unpleasant, but it's, you know, there's a feeling of invasion. We want to dispel it, get rid of it. So it's kind of challenging these things. So one of the practices that we do in the forest tradition is to play with reducing or getting rid of certain kinds of boundaries and things that we construct around ourselves to keep us safe. You know, so some of those are very obvious, like say wealth. You know, so we build up a store of wealth and we think that's going to keep us safe. At least theoretically, I didn't personally follow that particular philosophy, but that's what a lot of people like to do. Or maybe, you know, we have a house or something like that. So when we come to the monastery, those things we try, in a sense, that they're reduced. It's not that they're eliminated, but they're kind of, they're redefined, they're shifted. Some things which perhaps previously weren't dangerous and didn't need boundaries, and they need boundaries there. Other things where we are used to certain kinds of safety and protection, and then they're relaxed and we're exposed to dangers. And so, you know, especially if you're going and sitting in the forest and you know, places where there are dangerous animals, and then, you know, there is a certain degree of risk there. And in a sense, we're going back to nature, we're going back to a pre-civilized state, you know? I mean, this whole thing of living in caves, that's why I really like this idea, even though, you know, perhaps it's not all that practical. It's kind of easier to build a wooden kuti. But there's something symbolic about that, a whole idea of the cave. It's very, very, very primal. So a lot of the forest tradition practice was about putting you in situations where you had to respond in some way. You had to actually engage with, you know, your own defilements, with your own prejudices, with your own ingrained habits. And so it's not so much talking about the theory of that, but more plunging you into a confrontation with your own attachments, your own sense of identity. So that's something I think that's important for us to bear in mind here as we're practicing. And of course, as we all know, there are important ways that we differ from what the forest tradition has traditionally done. You know, we have a community where we're and supporting the quality of monks and nuns, and that's different already. We have an emphasis on the study and theoretical knowledge of the texts and the original languages and so on, and the Buddhist philosophy and things like that. So that's not so much a part of forest tradition as such. And so some things we do differ, and there are reasons for that. There are some aspects of the way that forest tradition has been or has become or has been lived that personally I have some problems with, and I'd like to try to, not necessarily that it's wrong, but maybe that it's got some things that are absent or out of balance or something like that. And so the fact that we're readjusting things, it's important to remember that this is done from a basis, and certainly in my case it's done from a basis of very great respect and gratitude to that tradition and to what I've learned from it. And I never forget, you know, how much I've owed to my own teachers, to the opportunity I was given to live in the monastery, to be fed, to have a kuti, and to all of those things which I've loved so much over the years. And for me to voice criticisms of these things, you know, some aspects of the forest tradition, you know, it's something that I do slowly. You know, I've done after many, many years of living and of contemplating and studying and so on, and which I do because I think that there is some criticism needs to be voiced in order to move forward in a positive direction. So I'm not somebody who, you know, I don't stand outside the tradition and just criticize it because I don't like it and I want to attack it. That's very easy to do. You know, if I wanted to criticize, say, other religions, you know, if I wanted to develop a critique of Christianity or Islam, or Hinduism from a Buddhist perspective, then that would be very easy to do. Yeah, and you could do that very, very easily, and tear the texts apart and tear the philosophies apart and all of these kinds of things. It's not difficult, but I want to put my effort into to somehow realistically assessing the strengths and weaknesses in the tradition that I've come from, and then trying to sort of constructively move forward with that. So I think it is important, even though we have this kind of emphasis on the suttas and so on, and I think that's where we need to place our main emphasis, but we also need to learn from and the forest masters, and you know, certainly encourage everybody to read what they can of the translations of Ajahn Chah's books and talks in particular, and also the other great forest masters, Ajahn Tet, Ajahn Lee, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Man, and so on. Because there is an incredible amount of wisdom in there. And for me personally, even though I never knew Ajahn Chah, but his teachings are always kind of strike me as being very fresh, very powerful, and very real. So for a lot of people, and so a lot of the monks that I know, they respond to those teachings very strongly. They find them very, very kind of a living example. And when it comes to the suttas, they're maybe not so interested. The suttas are a bit too abstract, a bit too distant, a bit harder to relate to. And so there's this directness and simplicity with the forest tradition teachers, especially with Ajahn Chah, which you know, many monks that I know find very inspiring. So I think, you know, it is a great thing to remember that you know, we're not coming from a tradition which is merely, the background of it is merely a textual reconstruction of a hypothesized earliest Buddhism. Okay, that's something which I do, you know, it's my, you know, hobby, my interest that I do, and I think that has a certain value. But that's only a small part of a tradition. And I don't want to sort of convey the misleading impression that because I do that, therefore I think that it's actually the most important thing. I don't, actually. I do it because it's my interest, it's my sphere of interest, and so it's something I have to offer. But not necessarily, but many other people have many different things to offer. So we should try to learn from those things as well. One of the reasons why I do, you know, I've become interested in the study of the suttas and the comparative studies and all that stuff is because it does seem to me that there's a deep sense in which the lifestyle of the forest tradition, the Thai forest tradition, has an important congruence, important alignment with those early teachings. Of course, that's what those monks wanted to do. Yeah? They also followed that same path, and they were following the textual reconstruction of Thai Buddhism in the mid-19th century, trying to put that into practice very authentically, and succeeded in doing so. So from my point of view, I've always had a very deep and quite almost unquestioned faith in the efficacy and the success of that practice in actually leading to the realization of Dhamma. Even though it's not something which I perhaps talk about all that often, it's certainly not something I want to make dogmatic statements about. I don't want to go around saying Ajahn Chah was an arahant, Ajahn Mahabhu was this, or Ajahn Mun was that. It's not my style, and I think that's a bit arrogant for somebody at my level of practice, which is, you know, hardly anything, to be presuming to judge people who are so much more advanced than myself. So I don't quite know why I've had that faith in the tradition, in the forest tradition, in that way. But there's certainly something about the level of authenticity of the lifestyle, in terms of you know, the real kind of rejection of all the kind of the fame and wealth and all of these kinds of things, and that's very, very genuine within the kind of the meaningful parts of the forest tradition. Of course, it's receded a lot these days. The forest tradition has become very big, bloated, wealthy, and so on. So that spirit is not there everywhere in the forest tradition, but certainly in some places it is. I always remember the passage in the end of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta where the Buddha says that when there are people to practice the Eightfold Path, then the world won't be short of arahants. And so, you know, when I look at the practice of people like Ajahn Chah and so on, I think, yeah, well, that's what they were doing. He was really practicing the Eightfold Path very, very diligently, with extreme diligence, extreme application and energy and perseverance through great difficulties. And it seems, from all the indications, that he reaped the results of that. And all of the people who knew him had that feeling. Well, I shouldn't say all the people, but many of the people, and certainly monks that I know, had that feeling that there was some serious development there. And one of the aspects of the forest tradition that I like very much is that the forest tradition is very relaxed, and especially about the formalities of things. The forest tradition has this kind of reputation of being very strict in Vinaya and Dutanga practices and so on, and of course that's true. But in many ways the lifestyle itself, actually, if you look actually how the monks are living from day to day, it's actually very relaxed. And so there's a sense of adopting a formal situation, holding your body in a certain way, wearing the robe a certain way at formal situations. And then when those formal situations are over, then there's a kind of an ease in moving into just being very relaxed and so on. And you can see it after Mahabhu's monastery. It's quite funny, they're kind of the whole scene, everyone running around and everything, and then so fast, like literally running around, people with huge big tubs full of all kind of food, sweating as they sprint from one place to the other, trying to get everything distributed in time. And then when that's all kind of finished as quickly as possible, then the kind of the monks sort of kicking back and having a fag and relaxing. And it's quite amazing, this whole kind of very efficient run thing, and then boom, and then it's all over, and then there's just this very simple bit of forest, and it's still very underdeveloped, and the monks are just relaxing. So there's a tremendous sense of ease, certainly, and it's part, I think, of the Thai character. It's an ease and relaxed nature in the forest tradition. That's not to say they don't work. Of course, they often work very hard, but there's also a lot of often just very relaxed. And so that's compared with, say, a lot of East Asian Buddhism, where it's much more. In Taiwan and Korea and so on, in my experience, is much more formalized and much more structured and all of these kinds of things. With the Thai tradition, there's a degree of formality, and then when that's over, then it's pretty easy, pretty relaxed. And so I like that, and it suits my kind of Australian character. So it's important that we have a good amount of time in our day, that we don't have to do anything, and we don't feel like we're kind of being pushed to do things all the time. Certain times we have to do the jobs, the chores, whatever, and then other times it's our own time, and then we can look at ourselves, how are we using that time? Are we just sleeping? Are we wasting our time? Are we doing some useful work to help? Are we doing some study? Are we annoying other people? Are we meditating? How are we actually using the time? And we can kind of reflect on that. But I think it is important not to be too not too neurotic about using time, setting up a timetable and saying I'm going to meditate this many hours and so on and so forth. You can do those things, and it's wrong to do it, but just to be a bit have a sense of ease around that. The compulsion to do, what we often found with the Western monks in Thailand was that they would always have to do something. You couldn't just not do. You'd have to do meditation, or you'd have to do working, or have to do reading, or you have to do something. Whereas the Thai monks would just have this quite extraordinary capacity to literally do nothing, literally nothing, not meditating, not resting, not. I'm not going to do it. Just hang. And completely happy just with that. And so that, I think that's quite a wonderful quality. We often found that when we're working, you'd have the Western monks would, when they're working, you start a job like, chopping wood or raking or sweeping or something, and the Western monks really sort of get in there and really kind of lots of energy and back and forth and build up a sweat and they're kind of glancing sideways at these very relaxed Thai monks and say, oh, these lazy Thais, blah blah blah, not working. But then after an hour or so, of course, the Westerner's getting exhausted and having to have a break, and then the tires just keep on going, you know, and they just keep on going and going and going, very relaxed, ease and pace, not out to win any records or prove themselves or anything like that, but just being part of that process. And something is very, you know, quite noticeable as a cultural trait is just that ability to just go along with things and not be pushing it all the time, not always having that kind of edge of making things be done. So that's, again, that's something for us all to learn, to reflect about, that's a good quality to be able to embody. So a lot of these things are things which you just kind of absorb. It's not necessarily part of the teaching at all, but it's just part of, you know, where you are, what's going on, what's happening. And in fact, as I kind of try to often point out, is that in many cases the teaching is actually the inverse of what's happening. So when you read what it says in the books, it's actually the inverse of what life is really like in the monastery. So for example, you read in Ajahn Chah, and or Ajahn Mahabhur, he's giving quite fiery talks. It's all about striving diligently, it's all about putting forth effort, you know, get in the ring, kick down those defilements, smash them in the teeth, you know, don't give up, and knock those defilements out, you know, kick them out of the ring and throttle them and these kinds of things. And you think, blimey, you know, well, what are these guys like? You know? When you go there, the monks just kind of hanging around, they're very relaxed and so on. Of course, it's because they're like that. It's because they're relaxed. That's why the teaching is like that. Yeah? That's what a skillful teacher is, counteracting the tendencies in the community. So when people are too relaxed, too at ease, then that's the teaching that they need. So that's the teaching that you give them. And for people who maybe are more obsessive, maybe more driven, goal orientated, always trying to push and achieve and get something, and then they'd be given the opposite teaching. Just relax, take it easy, don't try to do anything, don't try to get anywhere, don't try to be anybody. No. Learn how to waste time constructively. And sometimes so we need to recognize what's appropriate for us. And so, you know, we still have this hangover. You know, I still notice in myself very deep conditioning from ideas which you pick up at the start of your practice. And so for me, you know, my basic practice was learning Mahasi technique at Wat Rambang and being taught Abhidhamma. You know, that was the first two things that I did. I sat down and did an intensive Mahasi retreat, and then we did a series of Abhidhamma classes. First class, blackboard, 17 circles. This is consciousness. This is one mind moment and second mind moment, and that's what it is. That's truth. And so I just sat there and, okay, that's Buddhism. And you can see in my the way that I've developed and my teaching and writing and so on, that in some ways I'm kind of still responding to and trying to assimilate those things which maybe for yourselves might not seem relevant. Like, why, you know, what's relevant about it? It's not part of your experience. So no doubt you'll find plenty to be dissatisfied with in your experience at Santi. Yeah, you'll find plenty of things that Sujato does wrong, and then they'll need to be criticized and adjusted and changed later on. Yeah, and to do things in your own way. And so that's natural. That's not part of nature. So, but I think in that process, I think the Buddha was an evolutionist rather than a revolutionist. He didn't preach the kind of, you know, when he, say, for example, talked about the caste system, you know, he didn't sort of, obviously he didn't think the caste system was a great idea, but, you know, he didn't preach to have a social revolution and get rid of it. And so I think my intuition with that is that, you know, even things that we would think of as unjust, like, say, slavery. You know, he never said about abolishing slavery, or say monarchy. He never said, you know, the people should have the right to govern themselves. Although, you know, his own position would seem to be that that's what he favoured. So it seems to me that the reason why that's so is because in a revolution, that often the disruption and conflict and disturbance of that process itself causes more damage than the existing, you know, the pre-existing injustice did. And so it seems to me more, the Buddha was more like an evolutionist to sort of say, okay, we'll build on what's there to try to use skillfully the things that are there to kind of move it in a certain direction, nudge it in a certain direction, rather than trying to destroy it and invent something new. So I think you bring the same attitude into our engagement with the forest tradition. It's also to not think, you know, we know better. We don't, you know, and there's nobody here who remotely has the wisdom of an Ajahn Chah or something like that. You know, we can't hope to do what he did. Well, we can hope, but we certainly can't claim to be able to do what he's done. And, you know, remember that he set up a monastic order and a monastic system. You know, quite extraordinary to reflect on what he's done, you know, as a forest monk, you know, literally living in the middle of the forest. I mean, there's no, you know, it's not like telephones, and, you know, we've got kind of broadband and all these things. They didn't even have telephones, you know. And in those days, in Thailand was a very poor country. You know, it's not like Thailand today is very well off, but in those days it was very poor. It was in the poorest area of a poor country. There's a lot of social disruption at that time. There was communist revolutionaries in the forest. It was extraordinary to be able to do what he did and create a network of, you know, 100 monasteries or more, which all followed a similar system and a similar standard of vinaya and a similar lifestyle and similar commitment and so on. And then to set it up in such a way that's then continued for a generation after he's died, or he died in the early 90s but stopped teaching more or less in the early 80s. So really since the early 80s until now, it's coming on to 30 years now that since he's really stopped being, you know, playing an active role, and yet it still continues and still is very successful. So there's something to that. It's a huge accomplishment. It's not a small thing. It's a huge thing. It's almost unparalleled. There's certainly no other forest monks who've done anything remotely like that in Thailand. You know, the only thing you can compare it to in scale, you know, you compare it to, say, Bogwan Shan in Taiwan, which has a similar number of monastics and a similar number of branches. But of course, Bogwan Shan has been done on a basis of a very sophisticated technological and educational base, which is quite different from the forest roots of Ajahn Chah. So we have to be quite humble in the sense of what we think we can change and you know, to what extent we know better. Yes, of course, there are some things we need to change. There are some things which are not right, which maybe were right at one time. I don't know. Maybe we can't judge that. But for us here and now, it's not right. And of course, I personally believe that if Ajahn Chah had been born in Australia, brought up in Australia, practiced and realized Dhamma in Australia, he would have set things up differently than he did in Thailand. And so that's also very important to remember. So in our changing things and moving the tradition in a certain way, we need to try to do that in an informed way. We need to understand why things were done in a certain way and what the benefit of that is. And not just sort of understand that through reading about it or something, but we understand that through living in a similar way and living in a similar lifestyle. And understand that through, well, what is it, what practice of walking meditation? Yeah, this is very powerful practice in the forest tradition. You have a walking path in the forest, just a track of sand, just walking up and down. Yeah, being mindful, bringing mindfulness back into the body, mindfulness back into the sensation of the ground under the feet. Noticing as you go along, you notice the ants crawl along, you notice when the march flies or something come and bite you, you know the changes in the weather. This is part of the overall comprehension, and then focusing the mindfulness on the posture as you're walking. That's a practice which was done by the Buddha, practice done by the great Arahants, practice mentioned many times in the Sutta and Vinaya, and praised and practiced by the forest Ajahns. Very simple practice. And when we do that, we're just simply reflecting, we're embodying that tradition. We're just doing the same thing. Countless other bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen have done in the past. That's a very simple practice. And there's no, we don't have to reform that. There's no politics of walking meditation. I mean, there's a politics of it if you don't have a place to walk, right? And then you don't have a path or something like that. Then yeah, okay, that's different. But when you're there, the path is there. You're walking on the path. There's just you. There's just the path. That's all there is to it. And one step is much like another. One path is much like another. And over time, you'll have good paths and bad paths, good days and bad days, good meditations and bad meditation, and that will all be part of your learning experience. So when we're there, we're walking. Okay, that's what it's like. Just walking back to your kuti or your heart or whatever. Okay, that's just what it's like. Notice the sticks on the ground. Notice the leaves on the ground. Notice the roughness of the soil. Notice the blue of the sky. All those things are just there. And so we kind of keep bringing ourselves back to these things. Keep bringing ourselves back. That's where the joy and the treasure of the forest tradition is. It's in those things. And just to have a place and a place of seclusion, a place of quiet, is very, very beautiful. And if I compare to, say, in Indian Buddhism, in history, it seems that as kind of an interesting conundrum of Indian history that we read in the Vinaya, developed monasteries being built in Sarvati and so on, and yet there's no actual archaeological records of monasteries until several hundred years after the time of the Buddha. Nothing, not a scrap. And it's not till about the first century BC that you actually find monasteries that can be excavated. And when the monasteries start to appear, they're not real kind of forest monasteries as such, but the classical pattern is basically a quadrangle with rooms around it, a square with rooms around it, and the monastics would have their cells around there. And that pattern appears, I believe, quite early, and is maintained a lot through the Indian tradition. You can see in Nalanda and other places. And I'm very glad we don't live like that. And I'm very glad we don't live like, say, the monastics do in Korea or something, where you sort of, all bunk down in a hall. Imagine that, finish the talk tonight, and we pull out our mats and everybody's asleep in the hall here. And where Chi Kwan Sunim was talking about her training, and they just have enough on the mat to lie down and turn around, and that was it, and it's just one after the other, boom, 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 like sardines in a row. And you like that for how long? 4 years or something? Ridiculous. Anyway, I'm very glad that the Koreans find that a useful way of practicing, and I'm very glad that we don't have to practice that way. So we do have that chance to have a bit of a place in the forest. Aranyagatova, gone to the forest. So in the very interesting meditation is taught in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, where that perception of having gone to the forest is itself used as the basis of a meditation. You know, this forest is empty of elephants. It's empty of the noise of music and the sounds of the village and you know, all of those things. And therefore, there's a degree of emptiness there. And so this is your kind of meditation. You can take this back to your kuti. You say, well, what are all the things that are not here? And how many things are not here in my kuti? You can start making a list. Yeah. And you can even, you know, make it a practice. Look around your kuti and ask, what don't I need? And then just take all the things you don't need, take them out of your kuti. And some of you have, I know, when we've been going for walks around the monastery and so on, and then you've seen my kuti, and you know there's hardly anything in there, and that's how I want your kutis to be as well. When you get back to your kuti, have a look in it and see how much stuff there is. And if you haven't seen my kuti, then next time we go for a walk around, we can show you and then have a look in there. And I'm boasting here, okay? I'm allowed to. I'm the abbot, all right? My kuti doesn't have much stuff in it, and what little stuff in it I get. And don't think that it only has the little stuff because actually I've got it all in my office, right? Because it's been like my kuti's been like that ever since I've ordained. It's never had more stuff than that in, all right? So stuff in my office, I've got some spare clothes and a few bits and pieces, but mostly is just books and office things, and not personal possessions. And so this is one of the and you know you'll see that with Ajahn Chah was the same. In his kuti there'd be nothing. Ajahn Liam is the same. His kuti says nothing. Ajahn Mahabua, the same, his kuti, there's just nothing. You can imagine these monks, you know, they'd be given so many things, you know, people giving them so much stuff, you know, robes and cloth and pictures and rupas and all kinds of things. And it just all goes through, yeah? And there's this beautiful image in the suttas, like the water that rolls off a lotus leaf. And you know, it won't be wetted. You've seen the lotus leaf has this waxy finish, and the water just forms these beautiful dewdrops on there, and just comes off it. It's a very beautiful image. So this is how we should be with all the material possessions and so on. And you know, this is another great characteristic of the forest tradition. It's just that simplicity about things. Genuine simplicity, genuinely, just not having lots of stuff, just not being interested in having lots of stuff. A hassle. And so we, you know, we're constantly doing that even in the monastery, in the main buildings. It's just moving things through, you know, things which get offered. And then this is one of our dilemmas we've discussed many times, is because people offer us things and we're very grateful for it, they're very kind to offer things, but actually we don't want things. We want to have a simple, we want the monastery to be simple, to be clear, to be clean. So in that, coming back to the Chula Sunyata Sutta, and the that meditation on emptiness, which you can use to get this like progressive. It talks about this progressive descent into emptiness, and through contemplation of what's not there, contemplation of absence, contemplation of space, then the mind can go deeper and deeper into states of samadhi, because of course that's what samadhi is. Samadhi is just a letting go. Samadhi is the unification of mind that happens when the mind isn't distracted by stuff. And so you let go of stuff, and then it's natural for the mind to come into unification. So letting go, letting go, letting go of all those externals. Quite directly, we can use that as a meditation practice. And that's a nice thing to use, and nice contemplation to use. You know, you can do that as a meditation practice, just to think, what are all the things I've let go of? What are all the things that I used to have in my life that I've just let go of? Because sometimes in Buddhism we're conscious of our you know, very high standards, you know, things we should try to achieve and get to. We hold these high goals, and so we can be a bit depressed or down because we're not reaching those goals. You know, but actually to reflect and say, well, what have I let go of? What kinds of wrongdoing do I not do anymore? What kinds of harm am I not causing to people? What kinds of harm am I not causing to myself? What physical things do I not have? And in giving up those physical things, then I'm not only being of benefit to myself, but also, say, benefiting the environment. You know, maybe if I don't have a car, for example, well, that's, you know, reducing my carbon footprint by not, you know, driving around and travelling around all the time, being more settled in one place, then that's helping the environment as well. And this kind of reflection, the reflection that we've inherited this very noble, this very beautiful tradition, is extremely supportive for meditation. And so it's called the Aryavamsa, like the being satisfied with any old robe at all, being satisfied with any old dwelling place, being satisfied with any old food. And just to be satisfied with those things, just whatever, it's okay. So anyway, this is my little talk for you this evening on forest tradition and practice here. So I hope that's been some use for you. And does anyone have any comments or questions?